thatgreatbusinessshow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 78 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 11th of March, 2022. I'm Conal O'Moran. Lovely reaction from you to former News Talk business editor Vincent Wall, who joined me as co-host on episode 77 for a chat with Maxol CEO Brian Donaldson and fortune hunter Maeve Mullen. I hope to have Vincent back on soon again. Look forward to that. This week, we will be telling you about the inevitable for some 4-day working week. So make sure to spread the good news about this with your work colleagues by sending them a link to this podcast, and do it right now while you still remember. We'll also be telling you how you can make more money from your e-commerce business or side hustle. And we have two promoters of Ireland's nascent hemp or cannabis industry here to tell us about the business opportunities there, particularly if you are farming or in the construction industry. It's a brilliant timber substitute, according to our in-studio experts. It's what we do here on That Great Business Show, tell you where the business opportunities are and how to snap them up. That's because we just love talking business. And all of the great business insights on this podcast are brought to you thanks to our sponsor, DeFacto Shaving Oil. Man or woman, it's the best anyone can get. Buy it right now on DeFactoShave.com. I know that most SME owners work an 8-day week, working 25 hours a day. We on Team GBS share your pain. And then most people who work for those businesses have more regular hours, normally a 40-hour week spread over 5 days. But did you ever stop and ask yourself why those specific hours? During the Industrial Revolution, we used to work 6 days a week, and the average day was somewhere between 10 and, wait for it, 16 hours a day of work. So, why the 40-hour week now? Do we reach maximum productivity in that time period? What if you get your prescribed work done quicker? Should you be allowed to go home having done your work? Who should get the benefit of any productivity gains? So many questions. And here to answer some of them is my first guest, Joe O'Connor, the newly minted CEO of 4-Day Week Global. Joe has a long history of trade union activism, but what caught my attention is that Joe also has the smarts and is currently studying all about the possible future of the 4-day week at the hugely prestigious Cornell University in the US. Though not today, because he's in studio with us, I'm delighted to say. Joe O'Connor, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Great to join you, Colin. Thanks for having me.
The 4-day week, I think many people who work in a business, not own a business, dream of a 4-day week.
Well, it's an idea that certainly is capturing the imagination of not just workers, but a lot of business owners all over the world. We've certainly observed in 4-Day Week Global, which is the not-for-profit that I work with, that over the course of the last 12 months, we've almost stopped promoting the idea and advocating for the idea. And now most of our time is taken up with this ball that's rolling down a hill of more and more companies looking at this, trialing this, implementing this, more and more governments all over the world. Almost every month, there's a new government-led initiative around this concept of reduced work time. So it's a phenomenon that I think is really exciting at the moment, and looking forward to talking to you a little bit about.
And it probably fills the business owners full of fear, because you're just about to lop 20% off their working week, if I can put it that way.
Well, the whole concept, which, you know, in 4-Day Week Global, we talk about as the principle of the 180-100 model, which is the model that our founder, Andrew Barnes, implemented in his company, Perpetual Guardian, in New Zealand back in 2018. And what motivated Andrew to do this was not the obvious work-life balance benefits of this. It wasn't the issue of addressing burnout or stress or well-being, even though it's shown that these are things that come with reduced work time. It was productivity. And it was the fact that he was looking at most research would suggest that people are truly productive for about 2.5 to 3 hours a day. So Andrew was looking at this and saying, if I was to introduce an initiative that shifts the focus away from hours worked and away from the time people spend in the office, at the desk, or on the clock, and shifts that towards output and what people actually get done. Can I deliver better business outcomes?
Didn't the trade union movement for years and years and years fight against piecework, because of the way that it just put an awful lot of onus onto the employee and away from the employer, who may not have been able to supply the goods or the locations or the material or the machinery, and that he, she, the employer, was actually being smart by just saying, I'll pay you for what you actually deliver.
Well, I think the way you framed it in terms of the historical transition that we've observed, I mean, if you look at average work hours over the course of the last century, in most advanced Western democracies, they gradually reduced right up to around the early to mid-1980s. And since then, it's kind of flatlined. So we're working on average roughly the same as we did back in the 80s.
But hang on a second now. I've just, in preparation for this, I was looking. We don't really do a 40-hour week anymore. I was looking at some of the Americans there, American companies. They're offering 36 and a half. I think that I see PwC or Ernst & Young or one of those, you know, serious senior positions now, and they're clearly saying 36 and a half hours working week. That's a big chunk off your 40 hours.
It varies. There's lots of companies that are still working, as you know, 39, 40. There are companies that we've worked with who are, you know, at that 35, 36 level. But I guess, you know, the point is that we are working the same standard, the same default. We have the same, you know, normal work arrangement across the economy as we did back in the 80s. And this is despite the productivity gains and the technological advancements we've seen from globalization, from email, from the internet. So what we're increasingly seeing is the four-day work week is already there for a lot of companies. It's just buried under the rubble of bad meetings and outmoded practices. And when companies actually get serious about addressing these issues in a real way, they find that achieving the four-day work week and delivering the same or better output is not very far away at all.
What's in it for you? And I mean you, that to try to get the working week down to a four-day week?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Well, this is something I strongly believe in.
Based on what?
Well, based on, I used to work for a union, so I was very interested in this issue from a workers' rights perspective. That's what initially attracted me to it. I organized an international conference back in 2018, exploring the future of working time with a number of international speakers. I've been involved with the Four-Day Week Ireland group since 2019. And I guess, you know, even though I'm still working on the same issue, I'm coming at it from a very different perspective, because most of my day-to-day now is working with companies and CEOs and HR managers to explore with them how they can make this a possibility and a reality in their business. And increasingly, you know, you mentioned that this is something that company leaders are fearful of. Now, admittedly, there's a self-selecting bias with the kind of people I'm speaking to, because generally that is companies who already might have flexible working policies. They're quite progressive in how they think about work time. But more and more, we're seeing companies coming to us attracted to the four-day work week from a competitive standpoint, from the standpoint that they see that the new frontier for competition is quality of life as we emerge out of the pandemic, and that this is something that maybe previously they offered hybrid working, or they offered flexible working. They offered one of these different arrangements. Now, post-COVID, that's not a competitive advantage anymore in a lot of industries. That is the standard expectation. So these companies are now looking at what can give us an edge in terms of retaining our best people and recruiting and attracting better talent. And they're turning to the four-day work week because it's something that, if done right, can be done in a way that maintains or improves company performance while massively increasing the attractiveness of the company to its employees.
Are you differentiating between manual and other types of work, because you cannot just suddenly lop off a day a week and expect the same productivity if it is manual, strict manual labor, for example, or if you are front-facing in retail, like your staff doing a four-day week, like what happened to the fifth day? That's going to cost, because you have to stand there at the till or selling your jumpers or whatever. Are you selecting, you know, office-based work initially? Is that the thing? Is that the way into this for you?
Well, I think it's true to say that there are areas where it is easier to implement this immediately, and I think it's also true to say that the critical mass of interest in this, that the sectors where I could see this becoming the norm rather than an ambition within a few years. Are those sectors that maybe previously were traditionally office-based now might be, you know, remote first or have some version of hybrid? But it's also true to say that we've seen this work in, for example, manufacturing contexts. Toyota in Gothenburg have done this successfully. Volkswagen have got a number of departments that have switched to a four-day work week. We have a custom motorhome manufacturer, Advanced RV, that are doing this in the United States very successfully. And we've also got a hospitality group of restaurants, M. Tucci's restaurants, who've introduced a four-day work week across their entire business.
And how does it work, say, in hospitality? I can understand, say, on your RVs, because you will make a certain amount of the vehicle per day and you can walk off and come back in again on Monday. It's sitting there ready to go again. On hospitality, if your staff ain't there, you're not selling.
Well, what they've done is, and I think it's important to acknowledge as well that, you know, in M. Tucci's, they had a lot of people that were working 50 hours a week. And their four-day week has been a genuine reduction that's down to about 40 hours a week. So the starting point is also very important.
Now explain that again. Is this the classic that if I tell you you're going to work a half a week, you actually end up working almost a full week, really?
Yeah, this is you know, this is something they've done for both their management team, but also for their retail workers, for their bar staff. And they're doing it, you know, A, because they acknowledge that burnout and overwork within that particular industry is a concern. They're doing it because, you know, like we've seen with a lot of companies that have done this, this drastically cuts back on unplanned absenteeism, unplanned sick leave. It also saves companies time and costs in terms of recruiting new staff because they're actually able to maintain their current staff at a higher rate. So a lot of companies that do this find that there's a significant number of second order benefits to introducing the four-day work week, that actually even in those sectors where there might be an initial financial outlay in terms of do they have to take on more staff, do they have to cover more shifts, that actually trades off against each other.
But I presume that they find that they have to hire more staff. If you're certainly in hospitality, you can't leave the tables unattended, for example.
Well, one of the things that actually it's the Irish Hospitality Group in Sacramento have done, they have not hired more staff. But one of the things that they've managed to do is they've managed to improve the layout of the business. So in other words, they completely renovated their interior so that it meant, for example, for tipping, and this is a very US concept, but it meant that the distance that a member of staff had to travel between the till and travel to a table in order to serve them, it actually meant that they were able to get through more customers in a certain given time. They were obviously, they changed around their tipping policies, which meant that, you know, even though they were working less hours, because it's such a tips-based industry in the United States, they were getting a higher rate of tips from the tables that they were serving, and they actually managed to make it work in a way that... So, you know, there are creative solutions to a lot of these problems that businesses all over the world have managed to find, but it is true to say that it's not as straightforward as it might be in a traditional office-based environment in IT, in finance, in software. In a lot of these sectors, that's where we're seeing... This is something that's really taking off in a very, very big and a very serious way.
When I was doing a little bit digging around this subject, the numbers were absolutely astounding as to the how young people were. They were doing 10-hour days if you were around 12 years old, or between 9 and 12, I think they were allowed to have you working 10-hour days, and then it went up from there. Like, the history is a little bit dirty, to say the least, and yet the world has kept going.
Yeah, and look, this is something that strongly I was of the view we needed to have a serious conversation about well before COVID. And, you know, in the context of automation, digitalization, artificial intelligence, this fourth industrial revolution that's not coming, it's upon us. We need to talk about how we share the benefits of productivity advances and gains. And as it has been throughout history, working time is an important place for that conversation to happen. And I think particularly now as we emerge out of the pandemic, it's important the discussion around the future of work doesn't get constrained to location of work. And I think that there's a danger that could become the case with, you know, there's been such a focus on having the option of remote working. And I think that that's very important and it's very beneficial for a lot of people in a lot of different ways. But we also know that for a lot of people that when your workplace becomes your home, it can lead to, you know, difficulty switching off, difficulty disconnecting from work. So I think the conversation needs to feature location, control over work hours, but it also needs to involve the average number of hours that people are working each week? And why is it the case that in industries where we've seen these rapid changes and efficiencies and productivity gains, that people are still working the same amount as they did 20 or 30 years ago?
As on a point of principle, or whatever one might call it, do you believe that there are people who are work shy?
Yeah.
And the work shy will take advantage of this?
Well, I think the really important thing about this is that you can't think about this, or at least you shouldn't think about this, in the context of individual productivity. At the end of the day, if you run a business, what matters? What matters is your bottom line. What matters is, are we hitting our targets? Are we delivering our objectives? Are we satisfying our customers or our clients in the same way as we used to? Are we delivering a better product or service? So this is not about, are we squeezing as much out of Jim and accounts in 4 days as we used to over five? Because actually, if you're asking yourself that question, you probably might have an issue with Jim and accounts on a five-day week, never mind a four-day week. It's about, is the business still able to deliver the same level of efficiency and the same levels? And, you know, the powerful thing about the four-day work week, the transformative thing about the four-day work week, is there are few things that aligns company interests with individual interests in the way that this does if it's done right. You know, this is an incredibly transformative benefit for people in their day-to-day lives. You know, workers, when offered this opportunity on a trial basis, are incredibly motivated and focused and empowered to deliver the results and to hit the targets, because they want this to be made permanent, because it makes such a difference for them.
Well, once made permanent, it becomes the ordinary, the norm. So therefore, that kind of motivation probably disappears.
And that's why a lot of companies that do this, they don't do this on the basis of a contractual change. They do this on the basis of a policy, where effectively, you know, the arrangement is that they're paying people to deliver the output, deliver the service, maintain the standard, whatever it might be, depending on the kind of business or the kind of department we're talking about. They're only requiring people to work 4 days, and they're effectively gifting the fifth day off. So the arrangement is, you know, the critical thing is that within the culture and the mindset of the business, this cannot be, this is a one-off decision that we make, and then all of a sudden we're a four-day work week company. There are certain behaviors that are necessary to sustain this within the company. And, you know, this needs to be something people feel they need to continuously earn. It's like, you know, when you sign up for the gym, when you pay for a gym membership, you don't become fit and healthy immediately. You have to continue going and continue.
Oh, that's where it went wrong.
I know, you and me both.
So the four-day week, fine. But I also saw a different model, which was four-day week, yes, 10-hour day. What do you think of that one?
Well, it's not a model that we, so for example, the pilot programs that we're running all over the world, if a company comes to us and says, look, what we want to do is similar to what they're now doing in Belgium, is we want to give people the option, or we want to move people to 4 10-hour days. Because our program is all about shifting away from time to shifting towards measuring output, and everything we do with companies is geared towards that. If people are working the same hours, it doesn't work. You know, for the research that we're doing on our pilot programs, if people are working the same hours, that's effectively a reorganization or a restructuring of the same working week.
But they're still getting their extra day off.
Yes, and for a lot of people, that is, you know, I am aware of companies that works very well for. I'm aware of people who have been given that option, have taken that option, and where it's very, very good for them. But I also am aware of situations where people shifting from working 5 8-hour days to 4 10-hour days, their work is more intensive, and actually it has a more adverse impact on people's stress, their feeling of overwork, their feeling of burnout, because they're working, you know, 4 out of 5 days, they're working much, much longer shifts.
And what was that number that you gave me for actual productivity hours, or hours that we're being productive? Is it 2.5 hours a day or something?
2.5 to 3 hours a day. A lot of academic research would suggest that that's how long we're truly productive for.
So we really waste an awful lot of time.
And this is the thing, you know, when companies start to tackle this, and the first thing that we say is, you know, this should not be a top-down prescription. You know, the role of leadership here should be to very clearly set out the objectives, the targets, the measurements that success is going to be defined by, because that's really important. You know, if you trial this and then abandon it, but people don't know where it went wrong, you've got a problem. So that needs to be very clearly set out and very clearly communicated. And then leadership really need to get out of the way and not overthink this, because the most detail-oriented CEO in the world does not know the intricacies of every single one of their employees' jobs well enough to be able to identify, here's where there's waste, here's where there's inefficiency, here's the changes you could make to your work practices in order to deliver 4 days, 5 days output in 4 days. But some of the common things we see companies do is they get better at meeting discipline. So, you know,
Death to the meeting, yes.
Less meetings, shorter meetings, more agenda, structured meetings. Maybe there's some meetings that you've got your whole team on that maybe only a certain number of people need to be on. That's a very common one. Digital distraction, finding ways to tackle digital distraction, finding ways to automate certain processes within the business. Creating more structure, like reinventing your current workday, being very clear, you know, people having certain time for meetings, people having certain time for administration, people setting out blocks of time for focused strategic work on key priorities. That's another very common approach that companies take when they make this work.
What you're proposing is really quite radical. Well, it sounds very sensible in terms of just not wasting days.
Well, I mean, it's radical, perhaps, but I think it's also pragmatic and sensible and realistic. And I think that the companies who get this right are putting themselves at a significant competitive advantage, both in terms of their efficiency and their productivity, and also their ability to recruit and retain staff. And actually, you know, I would say that for a lot of businesses, your biggest risk is not whether you do this or whether you, you know, trial this and make this work and get it right. It's that your biggest competitor does it first.
I think I said to you, said at the very beginning that you're the newly minted CEO. How long are you in now?
There wasn't exactly a kind of a coronation date because it was kind of a longer, you know, I won't say a longer term transition, but so last week it was kind of formally
and well, congratulations. Announced. And the company or the organization of which you are now king, if you had a coronation, is 4 Day Week Global. What does 4 Day Week Global do in Ireland?
So 4 Day Week Global in Ireland, and we have the campaign group in Ireland, 4 Day Week Ireland, which is a coalition of businesses, unions, environmental organizations, the Women's Council from a gender equity perspective. So it's kind of it's got academics involved. So it covers the different, you know, we look at this through a economic lens, a societal lens, and a sustainability lens. So 4 Day Week Ireland is an affiliate of 4 Day Week Global. But effectively, 4 Day Week Global is an organization. It was set up by our founders in New Zealand after they successfully did this in their own company. They saw the benefits. They ran an academic research project with Auckland University of Technology alongside their own pilot. And it was set up really as a network of like-minded people who are interested in exploring the 4 Day work week as part of the future of work. And what it has developed into is really an organization that supports companies who are interested in either trialing this or making the transition to what we call reduced hour productivity focused working. So we've worked with hundreds of companies in different industries over the last number of years to support them to make this happen.
So I'm a technology company or an egg company in Ireland. What specifically will you do for me? Where's the help coming in?
So effectively what we're running is, we have a pilot program running here in Ireland that started on the 1st of February. It has 17 companies involved. I think Barry from Yala was on your podcast recently. They're one of the participating companies on the program. So effectively it's a 6-month coordinated trial. And what we provide is supports under 4 main headings. We provide workshops to companies in the lead into the trial to get them trial ready, which effectively involves us sharing the expertise of business leaders and companies from all over the world who've successfully implemented the 4 Day work week, often in very different ways. And the idea here is, you know, not that we have all of the answers and, you know, we're not like management consultants who will come in and say, this is what you need to do in your business. What we want to give people is access to a multiplicity of different experiences and expertise so they can choose the path that's right for them, because this is not a one-size-fits-all model. We have a mentoring scheme where they get matched up with another company of a similar size or of a similar sector who've successfully done this already. We have a network, so an online networking community where they can share ideas, solutions, approaches to shared challenges with other companies, not just on our Irish program, but on our other programs all over the world. And then we have a research project that runs alongside this. So we're partners with Boston College and with University College Dublin. And effectively what they're going to do is, if you're a company participating in our pilot, they will establish your baseline metrics pre-trial. So what does your productivity, your employee engagement, your well-being, your energy use, what do these all look like pre-trial? They'll track and monitor those metrics across the 6-month trial. And at the end, they'll produce an impact assessment so that you can see these are the impact on both the company and on our employees that the trial had. And obviously, you can use that information to decide, do we make this permanent? Do we abandon this? Do we change this? And so on.
Well, we don't like being negative on the Great Business Show, but what are the companies or the sectors least likely to benefit just at the moment? You know, the ones that, it's very hard to make this one work.
Well, I would say one obvious one would be healthcare. So if you take, there was a fairly well-publicized trial in Sweden a number of years ago where in a municipal care home, they moved the staff to a four-day work week. And the trial effectively wasn't made permanent. It wasn't made permanent because there was an increase in costs. There was an increase in employment costs. Now, the staff outcomes were incredibly positive. The patient outcomes were incredibly positive. But there was an increase in costs and therefore the thing didn't go ahead. And if you transpose that to the Irish healthcare sector or to, you know, most healthcare sectors all over the world, do we have an issue with overwork, with stress and burnout in healthcare professions? Yes, we do. I mean, there is so much data out there that shows that adverse medical outcomes come about as a result of tired or overworked doctors, nurses, hospital consultants, and so on. Would you be able to introduce a four-day work week within healthcare on the basis of a pure 180-100 principle, like we believe you can do with most industries all over the world? No, I don't think you could. I think it would require an increase in staffing. But actually, if you look at the broader conversation on the future of work, the types of employment that we're going to need to invest in are those that A, are carbon neutral, and those that B, aren't going to be automated anytime soon. And actually, within that context, I think you could make a strong macro case for some of those sectors that maybe this won't work as 180-100, but actually we could deliver better patient outcomes if we were to look at alleviating the overwork that we have got within those professions.
It really is a very interesting area. You're obviously enjoying your studies at Cornell. Final question that I have to ask all, that I wish to ask all guests on That Great Business Show. Who would you, Joe O'Connor, hire in a heartbeat?
So I gave this some thought earlier and, you know, I think we're very fortunate, even though we're a small organization right now. We're a small but growing organization. But we've got, like our founder, Andrew Barnes, is considered a serious thought leader in this area. We've hired Alex So-Yung Kim Pong recently, who's an author, speaker, and consultant, has written a number of books on the four-day work week. So I think we're very lucky to have access to that kind of expertise in-house. And I guess, you know, thinking about it in that context, one other person that I greatly admire, that he actually sits on our global academic board, is Adam Grant, who's a professor of organizational psychology at the Wharton Business School in Pennsylvania. And he's somebody that, you know, A, I see him as a serious thinker on the future of work, who sees the four-day week as being part of the conversation and the solution to some of the biggest challenges facing our economy and society. So having access to his expertise and resource would be incredible. But also, I think, you know, leaving the four-day work week aside, he's somebody whose leadership thoughts on, you know, how he believes you build a good culture within an organization, I would lean on. You know, he's somebody that if I see him come up on Twitter or on LinkedIn, more often than not, some of the nuggets he shares have an impact on my own leadership and management. So he's somebody, in the spirit of recommending someone that people that are listening to the podcast could look into, I would recommend Adam as being worth.
So Adam Grant, there's a lad in Ireland called Joe O'Connor who'd love to hire you. Joe O'Connor, Chief Executive Officer at 4 Day, that's the number 4 Day Week Global. Thank you very much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Make one small switch. Switching from shaving foam to all-natural De Facto shaving oil will give you the smoothest, softest shave ever. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto helps stop 20 million non-recyclable shaving foam cans go to landfills every year. Switching from shaving oil to De Facto will save your skin, your pocket, and your planet. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Small businesses often find it difficult to access the finance they need. Microfinance Ireland, the government-funded, not-for-profit lender, can help. We help businesses who've been unable to secure finance from banks or other lenders. We provide business loans up to €25,000 to businesses of less than 10 employees with a turnover of up to €2 million. For more information, visit microfinanceireland.ie or talk to your local enterprise office. Microfinance Ireland, funding small businesses in times of recovery and opportunity.
That Great Business Show.
When I think of e-commerce in Ireland, I tend to think of smaller companies based here, but selling to the world, like our sponsor De Facto Shaving Oil, made in Mayo, but selling their world-winning shaving oil literally across the globe. The reality, though, is a little less quaint. The biggest e-commerce player in Ireland last year was Amazon.co.uk, followed by Tesco.ie and Currys.ie. And I'm assuming that having heard the advice from Christine's of Crane WW Logistics on episode 65, Team GBS, that's you, our listeners, will have switched from Amazon's UK site to another EU site like the German one to avoid all those nasty post-Brexit charges. That Great Business Show is all about bringing you the best business insights. So today we bring you an e-commerce masterclass from Philip McCartney, Chief Commercial Officer at Belfast-based IRP Commerce. If it can be sold, Philip has sold it. So for the next 20 minutes or so, we're going to pick his brains. Philip McCartney, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
E-commerce. Who is doing it well? Who's doing it badly? Who could do it better? You keep rattling on now for 20 minutes and I won't interrupt you.
No problem. Well, e-commerce has gone through, as we all know, this huge seismic change over the last 2 years. Even in the start of the pandemic, IBM brought out a report that said, you know, in the first 6 months of the pandemic, we moved forward 5 years in terms of e-commerce. And we, with our own trading data in IRP, we've seen an awful, huge, huge growth. But it's a growth that's actually stuck as well.
Now that's interesting because obviously the bricks and mortar people are hoping to God that it goes back to the old fashioned. It ain't going back, is it?
Well, it's not rolling back anytime soon. And some of the, there's a fantastic report by Alvarez and Marcel that looks at, you know, what's going to happen in the future. And a lot of the pointers now are, towards not only the fact that it's stuck, it's going to continue to grow, but actually now there's a trend to move completely online, permanent online spend, which is where the high street will be getting a little wobbly. You know, so if you look at certain sectors like fashion, sporting goods, specialized sporting goods retailers you would see on the high street. They have now gone from a 9%, you know, only online only spend to about 30% online only spend.
This is
amazing. And that's reflected in the data that we see in IRP as well with our merchants. We see the same sort of spike.
Let me twist the question around into a completely different way. Would you buy retail commercial property at the moment? You see where I'm going with this?
Oh, you horrible person for asking me that. Well, I can feel my property friends now staring at their speaker going, don't you dare, McCartney. I actually think, I was asked this question before, I think there's a pivot point for the high street. I think it, you know, a lot of my merchants have their own high street stores. I don't, as an e-commerce person, I don't wish to see the demise of the high street, but I think it has a different place to play, a different role to play in the journey of the consumer now.
Such as?
Experiential stuff. You know, I mean, you like the touch, the feel, the texture, but I don't like having to carry bags around the high street. I like to maybe try on the size. I might be, like to feel the heft of something, whatever it may be. That tactility is something that we're always going to need. That experience, that rich in-person brand experience is going to work. But e-commerce has now grown up to a point where it can work together with the high street and just create a much more fluid, a much more modern experience for shop.
So I like a coat. I go in, I touch it, I feel it, and then do I get the hell out and then click the button on the bus on the way home?
You go to the pub, enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
And then when you get home, it'll be delivered the next day. Are you going to wear it there and then? How many times do you walk into a shop and put it on and walk out the door? Now, I've done that before, but how many times did
you pay?
Rarely. I don't like to talk about that time in my life. No, there is a mix now. And, you know, it is about finding how the high street works alongside e-commerce. Do you know what? It's just like back in, if you look at the end of the Second World War and the automobile came out and that suburban middle class came in, the suburban malls erupted. That didn't kill the local high street, but it had an effect on it. But the high street had to change and adapt and stuff. And it's going to be the same with this. It's another evolution. And it really, I think the key for the high street retailers to see, how do I evolve to match this new reality there.
And give the that part of the masterclass, part two, how do they evolve? In particular, smaller players. I mean, there's no point talking to the Amazons or to the Currys. They already know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But for those who are taking the early stages of that journey, what should they be doing?
So the first thing is to really understand your ambition. What do you want to achieve?
Sales.
How much? Where? Where do you want? You know,
as much as wherever I can.
Well, whatever you're saying, you can come sell on my platform, okay? The first thing I say to, you know, we work with the SMEs exclusively. And our SME merchants are, you know, hungry, ambitious. They want to be not just selling well in Ireland, not just selling well in the UK. They want to be global. And we have a, you know, a litany of, you know, brilliant examples of that that have happened on the IRP platform. But you've got to understand that ambition, because you need to think back to that whenever you're making your investments, whenever you're understanding what platform to be on, what partners, what marketing channels you want to use. All of that matters against your ambition. So think about it. You know, if you own a cycling store in Galway and you're like, you know what, I really know my racing bikes. I want to be an international. Well, we've done that. IRP have done that. That's the history of IRP. We're Chain Reaction Cycles. That's where we started.
Are you really?
We are those guys.
Because that is a case study that anybody interested in e-commerce should look at. When I heard of that story, and that's going back a few years.
That is going back a few years.
They took e-commerce by the neck, and my God, they have squeezed it.
That's my CEO. Now, I'd love to take credit for that, but I was too busy running around in Radioland in Dublin when that was happening, so I can't take credit for that. But my CEO and my CTO, they were the guys who actually did that. And they've used that way. They discovered just a, they just had a different way of seeing e-commerce. They saw it like it was trading. Right. So they approached it like the way a day trader would, the way a Forex trader would. They looked for opportunities everywhere, all the time, 24/7. And they were hungry, and they absolutely, they knew how to work it. So when that relationship ended, as all relationships naturally do, they took that ethos and the tech and stuff, and that's where they built the IRP platform. And that's what we do. So whenever I talk about ambition, we do hit back to that and Revolution Beauty and all of these big unicorns that have come through IRP. But what we say is, look, understand what you want to do, and then align everyone in your ecosystem around it. So, you know, agencies, et cetera, get them all around what you're trying to do.
I find it much easier to understand if you can give me real living examples. You don't have to name them, but just say to me a beauty product or a, I don't know, a football manufacturer, something like that, anything you want to, but just so that I can see where it started, how you helped them, and where they are now.
Yeah, brilliant. Let me take Camping World. Camping World. So this is, again, long before my time, but IRP got involved with those guys, oh, back maybe seven, eight years ago, something like that. So small distributor warehouse in the UK and stuff like that. They're now the number one outdoor store in the UK, selling tents, whirlpools, spas, hot tubs, camping equipment, whatever you want.
And is that down to the brilliance of the Camping World?
I always say that it is.
No, but no, seriously, yeah. Is that you must be doing, you must be very helpful to them. What are you bringing to the party that they may not have even thought about, but that you know about?
We have a different way of looking at e-commerce, right? And it is about connecting a lot of things together. The reason why e-commerce can be challenging for some people is that you've got a lot of noses in the trough. You know, Facebook want to take your money and tell you that they sold everything. Google want to take your money and tell you they sold everything. The agency wants to tell you it's them. What you need to do is actually have one point of data, one source of truth. Understand what you're looking at. Understand the profitability of what you're selling and where it's selling and who's selling it and how selling it. And have that as your, let's say, your sort of source of truth. Then you need everyone in your team to be aligned to your sales. So we don't charge a license fee. What we do is we take a percentage of sales. So if you're not selling, we're not making money. But when you're selling, we do well. So everything in our ecosystem is designed to sell and sell profitably. And it's really about aligning people, data, and profit all together. Because too many times, there's so many distracting things in e-commerce. Do you like this? Does this look good? What about this? It's about a focus on profit.
And there are big brand names like Shopify who are your direct competitors.
For sure, Yeah.
What do you do better than Shopify, or what do they do better than you?
Shopify are a brilliant everyman e-commerce solution. They have absolutely changed the face of e-commerce by helping mom and pop's stores get up online and start. We're for when you start to get properly ambitious. We're for those SMEs that say, you know, I've done about 500 grand this year, or 300 grand on Shopify, and I think I'm pretty good. I think I've found something here. So that's the point where you go and look at an IRP. Because at that stage, you need to get serious about your profits, serious about your margins, serious about your control, and serious about the people who are helping you sell.
Do you charge for your services? I know you take a cut of the profits, but before that, if I start the conversation with you, do I start signing checks to you?
Well, no, you take me out for a nice dinner, for crying out loud. You know, nothing in life comes for free. We are a pure tech company. We have an ecosystem of agencies and e-commerce experts that we can bring in, but that we also benchmark. So we don't, you know, do the sort of BS approach and say, they're brilliant, and not show that they're brilliant. We actually rate them and have them against their sales and growth rates and stuff. So you can actually see, and we're the only platform in the world that actually does that. So we've got a marketplace and ecosystem of agencies, which we're growing down here today, sort of speaking with them. But in terms of the relationship, you've got Shopify moving people from 0 to 10 miles an hour. Our job is to take them from 10 miles an hour to 70 miles an hour. And then they may build it in themselves. They may do this. And there's always an elastic limit to these things. But my company is the growth engine behind this. That's what we're designed to do. And I don't charge for having friendly conversations. Contrary to popular belief, I do not charge for having friendly conversations, but we are looking for partners. So I'm not an everyman shop. I'm not here to get it. I'm looking for genuinely ambitious merchants who want to go on the same journey as Revolution Beauty, you know, Chain Reaction, these sort of ones that we've done before. I'm looking for those merchants because this is a partnership.
It is also e-commerce, kind of it's a fad, but not, I don't mean a fad in the sense that it's going to be gone tomorrow. Some things have worked. Some things, you chase the people around the screen and say, are you sure you don't want two of these? Or the other one, which was that you've left this one behind, that kind of stuff. What's working at the moment?
It depends. It's horses for courses. It all works. There are countless new innovations coming through in e-commerce, making it faster. One of the ones that I saw this year at Web Summit in Portugal was, big one was headless commerce, whereas there is no checkout. You just buy it and that's the end of the transaction. So, you know, the way you go to something and it goes in a basket and then you bring the basket to an imaginary checkout.
But this is Jeff Bezos originally made a zillions out of the one-click wonder, wasn't it?
So now we're taking that outside. That's easier for Amazon to do in their mammoth platform, but now that headless checkout is now coming to local stores and stuff.
So I see a shirt, click done, finished.
Click done, out.
And where is my, maybe I'm going to say real fashion.
You've just been emailed it.
Where's my credit card element to it or whatever I'm paying with?
You've just been emailed it. But I mean, there's other, that's one that's coming down the line. I think it's a little bit risky, but good luck with it, right? I think it'll become the norm. Look at Ireland's greatest unicorn at the moment, Wayflyer. You know, they are absolutely betting the house on the fact that if you see good sales in e-commerce, those sales, that data means something, it's going to continue. So now you've got money coming in the other way. That's actually, again, building that trading mindset into people saying, look, I've just sold 100 of these bikes. If I had the money, I'd get 1,000 of them. I'd sell 1,000 of them. In steps Wayflyer to provide that. I mean, brilliant.
I'm hoping to have them on. I haven't had them on yet.
Klarna, I'll speak to them today. Klarna, another one. You know, I like that jacket, but it's 300 quid. But here, Klarna allows you to pay 3 steps now over 3 months or whatever it may be.
Oh, that's a little bit more dodgy because there's a pushback against that. Buy now, pay later.
So there's Klarna and there's Hum and there's other operators in that. But it's more, so obviously there's always going to be pushback against new things and maybe higher rates or whatever it may be. But look at what's happening. It's making it easy. All of these technologies I just mentioned, easier to buy, easier to sell, easier to buy, easier to sell. And that's where we think, it's our mantra is the sort of the future of e-commerce is trading in real time. Like, honestly, our vision is like trading floors where you have people who want things, people who want to sell things, and they're being brought together faster and faster and faster through multiple channels. Google, Facebook.
So just give me a living example of what you're thinking of there. Sounds intriguing.
Well, okay, I'll give you a great example from one of our merchants. So One of our merchants is called Anne's Cottage, and they're a sort of very cool, hip English surf shop based in Torquay and Devon. And they have, I mean, they grew 400% with us year on year on their first year with us. Fantastic trading mindset in the middle of the pandemic. So the summer of the first summer of the pandemic, they started trading to Trump supporters and the like in those sort of states, those sort of southern states in the US. And they were selling them beer coolers. And they sold hundreds of these things, right? Beer coolers. Now this is, think of the juxtaposition of that. A hip, cool English surf thing, you know, as left wing as it could get, Trump supporters buying beer coolers from them. But it was the mentality of their e-commerce manager to go, there's a profitable trade there to me. I can sell that from my warehouse. There is a need. They've run out of beer coolers in Trump Town for their NASCAR racing and all of those other things that I suggest they do. And they made the trade, and they made a profitable trade at it. And that's what I mean. It's the best e-commerce guys are absolutely barrierless in their heads, and they need the tools to help them make that profitable trade.
And that's fabulous. And are those people, and I'm not specifically talking about Anne's Cottage now, of whom I had never heard, but are they sitting around with a can of beer thinking, what else could we sell?
Yes.
That's it. Okay, right.
That's that mentality. I mean, today I'm speaking at our masterclass. And the only thing, I'm not there selling IRP. Honestly, I'm not. I mean, I may have a demo station at the back, but I'm really not. Really, what I'm going out to talk about is this idea of adopting a trading mentality to your e-commerce solution. If you watch the way traders work, they look for opportunity 24/7. It doesn't matter if they're trading coal, if they're trading Apple stocks. They're looking for profit and they're rigorous about that. But they also have everything aligned to know what they're doing. They know their stocks. They understand what other people are doing. They understand their data. They're sure of their data. And that's where e-commerce is going. It's almost a commoditization of e-commerce. That's where we're getting to now, especially post-pandemic, because we're looking at huge, huge, huge volumes and an infrastructure that makes delivery and shipping and all that sort of good stuff viable now. Really, really viable. So,
if you were going to choose an area of e-commerce to get into, and obviously you've been looking at an awful lot of areas, any suggestions of your favorite area? I won't ask you for your favorite product because that'd be,
oh, be
too
careful.
Much of an ask.
Be careful now. I can just, again, those eyes are on the back of my head from all my customers. You better say mine.
Maybe not. Maybe they want to keep off, you away from that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I might go off based on this one. I think what I would do is look at what are the worst bricks and mortar shopping experiences. And I think those complex ones where you're going into, look at very specific ones, you know, like we've got a brilliant customer who does fishing rods, fishing equipment and stuff like that. Now there's a tactility that you want in that, but also there's immense detail in these things. And I have a low boredom threshold, like a very low boredom threshold. Ask my wife when she shops with me. So anything with any detail, sort of specialist retail, sports retail, you know, those sort of things, I don't want to be standing around somewhere. I'm much happier browsing. I'm much happier with the information in front of me. And that's it. So something around that, something a little bit more complex.
And would you use one of those chat boxes or something? Because the nerds, and I know something about fishing, will be asking, what kind of a fly is that? How's that tied and all the rest? Is that... Would you use your bots there, or how are you selling to me? I'm not understanding completely about the, say, fishing rods. You don't want to go there, fine, but the nerd wants to stand there and touch it, feel it, and talk, and particularly talk. That's the Home Depot model in the States.
Yeah,
fellas who've done it. You like talking to them.
Yeah, so we've got the live chat function, and that really does help with, you know, conversion rates and stuff like that. There's more new things coming out with live chat with video and all that, which I think will be great. I think the thing about it there is that you just don't waste time because you've all of the content in front of you. People who bought this. There's actually a more of a trust element in that. If I'm a sleazy salesman, I'm like, do you know the last guy that bought this? He also bought this.
But when you see that on Amazon, people who also bought this bought, you know, a milkshake or something like that. Bullshit stuff. I mean, it makes no sense at all. So you haven't actually answered me of what area, sector of e-commerce would you like to go into? if the I'd
like to be in sports and outdoor equipment. I think that's
your area.
Yeah, I really think it's going to continue to grow and grow and grow. Because if you look, they're typically warehouse size now. When you want that choice, talking about 9,000-10,000 products, which means it's outside the town, which means you're driving to it, and that's just a pet hate of mine. I hate that.
Okay, I'm going to ask you two last questions. It'll become four normally. You were talking about the newer technologies like the bots and the video and all the rest. What is really, really, really driving sales at the moment? What should anybody, everybody in e-commerce be doing just of a small little tweak, a small little app, a small little anything to drive sales?
Move to IRP is probably the best thing. I said tongue in cheek.
So actually, before you leave IRP, you better tell people the function where you're based in the Titanic Quarter in Belfast, isn't that right?
That's right,
and
yeah.
You are available at all times. You're 24-7. Is that what you told me?
Yeah, don't give out my phone number, though. But yeah, so we are an e-commerce platform, like you said, just in the same way as Shopify and stuff like that, but with a difference, SME-specific. We deal with, fashion, sports, whatever, giftware, jewellery. Big names on us, Newbridge Silverware, Collective Clothing in London, the list goes on and on. We typically deal with businesses between 350,000 a year and upwards.
Of turnover.
That said, we have worked with a number of startups, very fresh startups, one who's down here today, where we would incubate them with one of our agencies. So we'd see something very special in the startup, said one's come down with us today. We would take them to one of our agencies that we know.
I'm so intrigued now by that. Can you tell me what area they're in?
So the startup's called Cozy Mac, and they do sea swimming at Macs and stuff like this. They're an amazing, amazing little company. We have a relationship with a brilliant agency up north called Built for Growth. We handed them to Built for Growth. We said, look, we think these guys are on to winner. Look after them for 6 months, prepare them for IRP. They did. They moved up into the 500,000 a year range very, very quickly. Wow. And now they're on the IRP and selling internationally.
And will you send Build for Growth to me as well?
Built for Growth.
Oh, so Built. Yeah. Will you send them to me, please? We'd love to have them on the podcast.
Not a problem.
Now, my final question is, and I think and I hope that you've been prepped for this. Philip McCartney. Actually, here's the other one. Are you related at all to Paul McCartney?
No, but my wife is called Linda McCartney. So
I get away.
I swear to you. Okay. So it's caused all manner of fun.
And she's not a photographer, though.
No, nor a vegetarian either. So, okay.
Who would Philip McCartney hire in a heartbeat?
So I was going to go for a little bit of a hero.
You did read the email.
I did read the email. I didn't do a lot of things in it, but I did read this part. So I was going to go for, one of my heroes or something like that, go for O'Driscoll or something. But actually, I'm going to go for Gary Vaynerchuk. Do you know Gary?
I know. Well, I haven't met him yet. But a lot of people who come on here swear by him.
Yeah, he's top class.
How has he impacted on you?
Well. So in a couple of ways, but I used to be, social media used to be my game. So if you remember Bebo back in the day, I used to be head of Bebo Ireland and stuff. And I was indeed.
That's not on the LinkedIn that I looked at, is it?
It is. It's shining proud. You missed that one now.
I could have had another half hour chat.
Listen, we're not talking about Bebo anymore.
I know, but where's Bebo now?
He sold it again. He sold it twice.
Anyways, Gary Vaynerchuk.
So Gary was a big leader in social at that time. But also, when you look at, he does these brilliant videos, he's a trader at heart. He's a trader. So he started off with his parents' wine business, but he is a buy for X, sell for X plus Y. And a friend of mine from Dublin went over and worked for him. And Gary sent a beautiful video message to his wedding in Ireland when he got married, and he's super sound. He's one of these just really good people. But because I'm, because of our beliefs in trading and trading being the future of e-commerce, I'd want a maniac trader like that in my business. So he'd be my first hire.
Sounds good to me. Gary Vaynerchuk, you are now hired. Philip McCartney, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Small businesses often find it difficult to access the finance they need. Microfinance Ireland, the government-funded, not-for-profit lender, can help. We help businesses who've been unable to secure finance from banks or other lenders. We provide business loans up to €25,000 to businesses of less than 10 employees with a turnover of up to €2 million. For more information, visit microfinanceireland.ie or talk to your local enterprise office. Microfinance Ireland, funding small businesses in times of recovery and opportunity.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Rate and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Subscribe today to That Great Business Show on your favorite podcast platform, including Apple and Spotify.
Hemp is cannabis without the hit. And according to Hemp Cooperative Ireland, it appears to be as good as, if not better, than the slice pan. According to its promoters, hemp is a wonder crop that can be used in health, clothing, construction. It can attract younger people into farming and can even help stop cattle farts. And there could be unforeseen business opportunities in hemp for your business. And that's why we have asked two members of the Hemp Cooperative Ireland board to tell Team GBS all about the wonders of hemp. Dr. Robert Johnson wears many professional hats, including that of R&D manager at Arigna Fuels in Leitrim, where he has been for the past 11 years plus. And David Hartigan, who is a manager with PwC Ireland with an interest in emerging technologies. Robert Johnson, David Hartigan, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thank you. Nice.
Great to be here.
Yeah.
Hemp. Talk to me all things hemp. Who wants to take it first about all things hemp?
I might as well start from the beginning. Okay, so hemp has been cultivated in Ireland for thousands of years, and it's only recently that, with the Misuse of Drugs Act, unfortunately, that and the price of cheap oil, that all of the goods that were made from hemp are now were changed over to be made from oil products.
Where does hemp grow? How does it grow? What does it look like?
Okay, it grows in relatively good soil. Obviously, it was cultivated in Ireland for a long time, so it grows in Irish soils. It's happy in Irish soils, but we have a slight issue in that we have to buy seed from abroad. So what we haven't got is a
seed. Is that because of illegals?
It is because of illegals, yeah. We haven't got an Irish certified seed as yet. So that's something that we're looking to do.
And where's the old seed gone? Did anybody ever put that into a vault somewhere, or is it in a museum or anything like that?
That I don't know. David?
To be honest, I'm not too sure, but kind of back to the legal point.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I just asked you a question. I now sound intelligent.
Yeah. Probably something we should look into. But,
the legals.
On the legals. So the interesting thing with hemp, as Rob talked about there, was the fact that it was kind of vilified for so long, and it's kind of, that's how it's kind of, I suppose, fell out of fashion in a sense. So up until 2018...
That's where it fell into fashion, I think.
Possibly. So up until 2018 in the US, it was only when the Farm Bill was introduced that hemp actually went from Schedule 1 drug, which is bizarre to say. So hemp in the US was actually in the same schedule as cocaine and other Schedule 1 drugs. So to grow hemp was completely illegal in the US up until 2018. And it's only since, I suppose, that regulation change and now it's really started to flourish in Europe that things have started to, I suppose, pick back up. So that would be another reason why there isn't, I suppose, Irish seeds in Ireland, because for so long it was completely an industry that was deserted.
Botanical gardens may have some for you. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Because what we're here to do is to pick your brains to say, what are the business opportunities in hemp? Because there are many. Robert?
There are, yeah. It's the problem is with pinning down one particular channel that we want to go down. So what we're looking for this year particularly is fibre. So fibre to make insulation, clothing, anything that's...
Yeah.
We're growing for fibre this year is what we're asking for farmers to do.
And how does a farmer, one, get involved? Mm-hmm. What does he, she need to do? How much land... fertilizers, cost, income.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so the first thing they need to do is join the Hemp Co-op, obviously. So so join Hemp Cooperative Ireland. Well, our website is hempcooperativeireland.com.
I found it.
.com. Yeah, exactly. Send us an email, info@hempcooperativeireland.com. And the first thing to do is then apply for the license. So the license has to be obtained from the HPRA, which is the Health Products Regulatory Authority. And
is it hard to get? Is it expensive?
You have to. It's free. The license is free, but you have to go through a check.
What do they check for?
Well, they check that you're not going to do anything untoward.
But how do they know?
Well, they don't know. Like, yeah, it's a bit like sort of the analogy used is, well, it's a bit like growing barley. And so, well, it might be used for whiskey.
Yeah.
You know, it's that type of thing. Like, it's a benign plant.
Exactly. And to that point as well, so like, it is regulated to an extent. It's probably not to where it needs to be in terms of the regulation, but there is regulation. So it is licensed. So you can't just go out and buy hemp seeds and just decide you're going to grow it in your garden. You do have to get a license. And as part of the license, there is a Garda check. So they do a background check to make sure that you've no previous drug offences or anything like that. Also, where you grow it, they're quite particular in where you're actually allowed to plant the seeds.
Such as?
So you couldn't, say, grow it beside a school, for example, because when it's actually grown, it does look pretty much identical to actual marijuana. Like,
but it is fundamentally different.
Yeah, it's fundamentally different from a chemicals perspective.
So what matter if it's next door to a school?
I think it's just the public perception, probably. Yeah.
So one day this country will grow up.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's only me giving out.
Yeah.
Back to the business case. How long does a crop take to grow and how much money can a farmer make out of it?
It's a 120-day crop. So from sowing to harvest is 120 days, particularly for the fibre.
Yeah.
It's a little bit shorter if we were allowed to harvest for the cannabinoids, the medicinal use. There's a stipulation that's just come out in the license this year that says that the flower and the leaf must be destroyed. So it's something that we're going to have to come over and...
I mean, while the rest of the world is producing this stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
For medical use and they're proving...
For
that
a country that lives, thrives on alcohol, we are nuts, aren't we?
And a good way to put it in perspective, because I was only at an event last week in London and I was actually speaking to some people who are involved in, I suppose, the hemp industry. And I actually got speaking to a guy, I think he was London-based, but he was telling me in Thailand, of all places, which are notoriously known for being extremely strict on drugs to the point that you can even get the death sentence, they've actually completely changed their perspective on it. And now they're growing hemp and they're processing the whole plant, including the likes of the flower and the leaf. And they're even going down the medical cannabis route as well. So it goes to show you, I suppose, times are changing elsewhere, but we are lagging behind compared to, I suppose, like even the likes of our EU counterparts. Mm.
Both of you are even worse than me for going down little rabbit holes.
Yes.
Business.
Yes. Okay.
So it's 120 days growing.
That's right.
Then what do I do with my harvest?
The harvest, at that point, then it can be harvested, as you say, baled, and then it can be sent off for processing. And what we're really happy to sort of announce, really, that there's one processing unit up in County Leitrim, on the border of
Live,
where I live, exactly. Yeah, on the border of Leitrim.
You've actually forgotten where.
Yeah, it's on the it's right on the border. So in my defence, and I'm not a native, so. And there's another one looking to be built in County Meath. So two processing units, they're called decortication units, and this separates the fibre from the woody shiv and produces two products.
Per acre, input costs, output profits.
Ooh, input costs, okay. For fibre, you're looking at about 7 to 8 euros a kilo for seed.
Yeah.
You need 20 kilos an acre, roughly.
Yeah, roughly.
Roughly to sow, so you're talking about 140, 160. Euros there for per acre. Sale price.
Well, hang on, do you have to feed it with fertilizer or
fertilizer? We would recommend, and we do recommend that slurry is fine, but we'd be moving away from artificial fertilizers for multiple reasons, from the carbon cost, the nitrogen content, the soil needs to be tested basically. And then you need to find out how the farmer needs to find out exactly what they need to add in.
Okay. So 120 in.
140 in, roughly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I harvested it. It's a beautiful crop.
Yes.
And I bring it down to either Leitrim or to the new plant in Meath. Mm-hmm. How much will I get?
Well, it's what the producer has said is that they will pay the average price over the last 5 years for winter barley. That is the price that he's given. So tillage farmers would know what their prices are. It'd be in the region of 200 euros a ton, and you'd be looking at between 3.5 to 4 tons of if you had
per
a
acre.
Good crop per acre.
Okay, that sounds like decent money.
It would be. If you could utilise the rest of the crop, so if the seed, and if you could utilise the cannabinoid species, i.e. the medicine, then that grows exponentially.
Oh,
that
really does.
Okay.
The price per kilo of this particular material is worth thousands.
And why was I told specifically that this is going to attract young people into farming? Is it about the excitement of growing cannabis?
You're probably best asking David. He's done it. So
I shouldn't say cannabis because, of course, hemp is not cannabis. Isn't that correct? It's the same family.
Yeah.
But cannabis has the hit. Hemp doesn't have the hit.
Yeah, ostensibly they're the same thing. It's just they are genetically bred to have a lower THC content, which is that's the psychoactive part.
I'll tell you what that is. Tetrahydrocannabinol, isn't that it?
Cannabinol, yes. Very good. Yeah,
exactly.
I know that you don't like your acronyms.
Very good. Now, back to the business case. So it goes in. What happens next? It is processed, and is it mulched up, or is it shredded, or what happens?
Essentially shredded, with the decorticator. So once it's shredded, as Rob said there, you get your shave, and then you get your fibre. And essentially then the fibre can be made into a number of different products, so like insulation and other building materials.
You're very keen, or the organisation, the cooperative, is very keen on the whole replacement of building materials to use hemp.
Mm.
Why?
Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of them is through carbon sequestration.
Yeah.
So that's obviously, it's a very, very hot topic and has been for a while and will continue to be in the future. By using the hemp shiv to make hempcrete, which is basically a blend of hemp, lime and water, that's it. It's just three constituent parts. Blended together, that can be applied in the house. It can be used to...
When you say applied in,
is it
like a lime wash or something? Or does it come in blocks?
It can be made into blocks,
or you can do it on site. So you can actually, you can do it...
And is it expensive? In other words...
In comparison to other material, I don't think
it's expensive. Makers are not known for being very benign.
Mm.
So they will stamp and stomp on you if you come in with a cheaper product.
Well, it's the filler. That's the problem. So the filler for concrete is aggregate, which is very cheap. But the filler for hempcrete is hemp and lime. There's only two real constituent parts to it. It's not, at the moment, this is part of the problem. The supply is limited. The prices are high.
If we had
more supply
of
hemp shiv, then the cost would come down.
Are there places in the country on the island of Ireland that are better at growing? I mean, does it grow well in the west, east, south, north, where?
We have farmers all across the country. But in particular, we have one particular farmer in Wicklow would be doing incredibly well. The east.
When somebody like me hears incredibly well,
yes.
Does that mean that he's very happy and he drives a nice big car or something, or does he put a stash of cash into the bank balance every week or something?
Well, yeah, I think the joke about farming is that if you want to make a small fortune in farming, you start with a large fortune. So, and he would have invested heavily over the last 5 or 6 years or longer.
Yeah,
I think 8 years he's been growing.
And how come? Because I know farming is exceptionally tough, and the ups and downs, and weather and all. How come farmers are not literally flocking into hemp?
I think there's a lot of people that are risk averse. I think a lot of people, particularly farmers, have been hit
maybe
with
older farmers, but younger farmers. I mean, you see them trying anything. Mm-hmm. Like they've tried ostriches, they've tried kangaroos, they've tried this and the other. They'll try anything really.
And we're attracting those people.
Yeah,
we're definitely attracting those people. We're attracting dynamic, younger. I'm sort of saying this again, but we are. But it's across the board. And for other farmers that are saying, well, for legacy things, okay, what am I going to do with the farm? You know, running a beef cattle up in Leitrim, can I do something else with this? Or can I set aside something? Can I offset my carbon by doing this? And when that's another very, very, you know, it's in the minds of the carbon footprint is everything. The carbon footprint on a litre of milk is approximately 1 kilo of CO2. So again, dairy farmers are also looking at, okay, how can I offset my dairy farm emissions?
What enticements or incentives are there for farmers to start hemp farming? Any? None?
This probably comes down to the barriers.
It does, yeah. It is absolutely the barriers, yeah.
So there's like a number of barriers within the industry. Obviously, one, the industry is still growing. It's in its infancy in Ireland. So a lot of the machinery and equipment that we need isn't actually here. So like the likes of France, they have a huge, thriving hemp industry, and they have for a number of years, and they're actually one of the largest producers of hemp in Europe. But that's because they have the machinery, they've grown the industry. And secondly as well, apart from the lack of infrastructure that we have, which the co-op is trying to address through like regional hubs, and then also working with kind of, I suppose, third parties who are setting up like the cortication facilities. The other big barrier to, I suppose, the industry growing will be government support. So as it currently stands, there's kind of, somewhat of a conundrum, I suppose, in the law is the best way to put it. So our members would be given a license to grow hemp. I've previously had a license myself, and you're allowed to grow up to 0.2% THC. And
where were you growing it?
I was growing in Wicklow.
Okay.
Yeah.
Successfully?
Somewhat. I was actually joking with Rob before we got in here. I had issues with wild deer. They actually love it. They were eating it, yeah.
Because, of course, they are right across the country, really.
Of course.
I'm very, very familiar with Wicklow deer as well. So you have to fence it all in.
Well, that was kind of the...
And fence jump very high.
You want to put 7-8-foot fencing. So that was kind of the issue I had. And at the time, it didn't make sense to fence 3 acres, 8-foot high. So I kind of just left it be. It was kind of a learning experience.
And if you had grown successfully your 3 acres, what kind of profit, straight profit, you work for PwC, you understand what I'm talking about, what kind of money would you put in your back pocket?
To be honest, I actually wasn't too sure because I don't have a farming background. As you rightly said, my background is in business. It was more of a trial to just see how it would work. And then I was kind of looking at it from probably the seed side of things in terms of actually getting hemp seed. Hemp seed works great. You'll see it in most Tesco's or Holland & Barrett's where you can buy it and put it into smoothies, salads. They're just very high in nutrition in terms of their protein content, vitamins, minerals. So that's kind of the element I was looking at, not so much for fiber. But I suppose I never got there in the end. The deer kind of got ahead of me.
So what would you like the world, particularly those listening to this podcast, to do? Because you're here to sell hemp, mm-hmm. not to sell it to me, but to sell the idea of hemp growing, hemp industry. What do you want people to do?
I suppose one of the main things we're trying to do is grow the industry. So back to the point there in terms of the barriers, there's a massive kind of mismatch essentially with government regulation in Ireland and then EU law. So like our members are given licenses to grow hemp, which will naturally contain a small amount of THC, which will always be there. The only way to get rid of it would be genetically modify the seeds. And it's at such a low level that it wouldn't even get a frog high. It's basically minuscule. it's just essentially there. It always will be. It's naturally contained in the plant. And because of this, we actually, I suppose we fall under the Misuse of Drugs Act. So where the conundrum falls is we have members who have a license to grow a product, which once it's fully matured is technically illegal under the Misuse of Drugs Act because it's 30, 40 years old.
I saw your chair, the chair of your co-op, in front of the Doyle Committee, the Justice Committee, and were our legislators, I won't use any other word, were they listening? Is there any chance that they'll just say, come on, let's do this?
The tide is turning, definitely. We are...
Who are your big supporters in the Doyle, do you know?
So Matt Carthy would be a big supporter. Pippa Hackett would be a big supporter of ours. We are
people.
David's actually doing a great deal of work behind the scenes for the co-op in lobbying, in approaching TDs.
Yeah,
most of them are on board. It would seem that those in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael less so. I've been knocked back, let's say, by the
or maybe even a majority of them may have a farming background. So I would have thought that they probably would have understood it a little bit better. Yeah, I love that analogy with barley, for example. I mean, just what is it going to be used for? It depends. And you can also make clothes out of hemp. We used to, bags were, I mean, certainly as a kid, we had hemp bags or bags of hemp. No, we didn't have bags of hemp, I promise.
Well, the interesting thing is, because if you want to look this up, there was a campaign done in during World War II called Hemp for Victory. So during World War II, they were actually promoting the growth of hemp because it can be used in everything from like ropes, building material, sails, military clothing. And through history, hemp has always been used for fabrics and especially for sails, for ships and everything.
So back to that other question I was asking, what do you want the public to do? What do you want the growers? Like you, as you say yourself, David, nothing to do with farming, but you found 3 acres somehow down in Wicklow and you could be doing this as a nice side hustle.
Yeah, well, I suppose what we'd like is more people to get involved in the industry because the industry will only grow as more and more people get involved and support it. Like it has huge potential. Even Chagas have done their own report on this and said the hemp industry as a whole in Ireland has the potential to create 80,000 jobs
over
10 years. Yeah.
Now, I'm old enough to see that every industry claims something around 80,000 potential. Mm-hmm. So if we were to aggregate all of the above, well, we can't get enough workers to work what we have at the moment. So good luck with that. You really want people with land at the moment who could just turn it on. Their growing season is from when?
Kind of end of April until kind of September.
Is it too late to sow now?
Oh, no, you wouldn't be sowing until... when I say that, that's sowing. Sowing at the end of April, beginning of May. It's after the last frost.
So a perfect time now to sow. Mm-hmm. And if I went down and if I joined your co-op, would you... And I get my Gorda check and I get my piece of paper. Jeez, I'm getting tired already.
Yeah.
where do I buy my seed and how quickly can I get it?
Okay, you buy it through... You can buy it from lots of online sources, but you can buy it through the co-op. So that's part of what we offer. So... we have a two-tier system. If you're a member, you get it at X price. If you're not a member, you get it at Y price. And you obviously, if being a member, you get a discount. That's we're a cooperative.
Well.
You know, I'm the son of socialists. So this would be a collective bargaining. You know, the people power, bringing people back to the farm and getting the farm to generate money. I think that's key to this. I'm also a pragmatist. You know, we have to get the farmers making money, and that will grow the industry. We had a meeting. Okay, so just to go back, we had a meeting with the Department of Agriculture, and this was in late 2019 when I just joined as a board member. And they basically said to us at the time, unless you're at the stage of the acreage of winter barley, we're not that interested. I'm paraphrasing, but that's effectively what was said. So we need to be at sort of 2,000-3,000 acres.
Like a lot.
It's not a lot, but France has got 20,000 acres grown. So,
is there much maintenance? I mean,
it's literally.
It's quite easy in terms of.
Sow it and forget, basically. You know, and unfortunately, last year some of our farmers had a problem. We had a late frost, so that killed the.
That's farming.
This is farming, exactly. Mm. So look, this happened, but so they had to resow.
So there's no problems except for the frost.
Yeah.
The deer. Disease? Is it okay disease-wise?
Mold. We live in Ireland. There's a history of mold.
Okay.
Botrytis particularly, which is a very specific type of mold that grows on the plant. In the illicit community, they would call it bud rot. You're not going to be able to use that for medicinal or extracts if it's full of mold.
Yeah.
That's kind of clear.
Right.
But for fibre, it doesn't matter quite as much.
Anybody who wants to get involved should go to the website. And the website is?
It's hempcooperativeireland.com.
I'm delighted that you didn't start putting in the www.
It's a waste of
time. Nobody ever puts that in anymore.
Yeah.
And you know, I have a final question, or in this case, two final questions, because I'm going to ask you both.
Okay, yeah.
Hire in a heartbeat. Who wants to take it first? David. Okay. You're looking as if you don't know what this is about. Did you read the email?
No, Rob has actually told me this already, so don't worry.
Okay. But it means that you were going to take one person between the pair of you,
right? Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, we do that, so.
Is that, if that's okay?
Of course. This is that great business.
The thing is, we're looking for a manager. So we're looking to hire a manager. So we agreed at the last AGM this year that we need a project manager for the co-op. We're bootstrapping this. Like we are all the board are voluntary. It's all our own time. Yeah. We're putting an awful lot of hours in. But we need now someone, we've got to the stage where we have to get someone to do the day-to-day management of the co-op. So we want a project manager. We want a great communicator. We need someone who's who's good across the socials. Yeah. We need a whole package, really.
Yeah, they're going to have to wear a couple of hats.
Yeah.
And name that tune. Who are you thinking of?
Do we have anybody in mind?
Don't think we have any point is just in mind. We yeah. like the name. Somebody was okay. looking for Roy Keane the other day. He'd be a project manager. He'd kick ass.
Do you see, I really look at what James Belushi is doing in the States.
Okay.
For the cannabis industry yeah. specifically. But yeah, Jim Belushi, that would be great for us, I think.
That sounds like he would have the visibility for, you know, it would attract attention as well, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that is most interesting. Sounds kind of like a no-brainer.
We think so.
Yeah, clearly.
And that's the thing, and that's what we're hoping in terms of, like, we had the meeting, obviously, the committee meeting last week or the week before, the agricultural committee meeting with the Dáil. And
that's online if you want to see that.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I mean, you've paraphrased it there. I went, I sat through it. So, you know, there's a big business in it.
Yeah, and we've got definitely. An event. I didn't plug the event. We've got we've got the hemp event coming up, the Hemp Event 2022 in partnership with Chagas. So we're having it at Ashtown on the 8th of April.
Okay.
Yeah.
The hemp event.
And if anyone is interested in hemp, that's definitely an event not to be missed. We've some fantastic guest speakers there who are going to be discussing everything from, I suppose, CBD to building materials to carbon sequestering. So it goes across the whole range of, I suppose, the benefits of hemp.
But they can also listen to That Great Business Show.
Exactly.
But anyway, a hemp event sounds very interesting. Listen, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Robert Johnson, David Hartigan, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 78. Please share, like, retweet this podcast with all of your connections on social media. And do it now, please, before you forget. It's a click of a button for you. It's commercial success for us. And make it easy on yourself to enjoy your favorite business podcast by also pressing the subscribe button. And of course, you can always, well, we call it talk to us on our LinkedIn page. Great brands like Big Red Cloud, Microfans Ireland, ISME, Virgin Media, Udo's the Goethe already advertise with us. They are all Team GPS approved, so please give them your commercial backing. And if your business would like to advertise on what you say is Ireland's best business podcast, do get in touch with us today. Special thanks to Groena McGarvey at Pulse PR in Belfast for sending us Philip McCartney, and thanks to Stephen Barry Hannon for linking us with the Hemp Co-op. As always, my thanks to all of the team here at the Dublin Podcast Studio, including today's sound engineer, Davide Murray. He likes that. The Davide is kind of from Sicily. Sardinia, oh my God, I've just said the wrong one. Anyway, he's from over there. Later, Peter Rice will add some extra long whooshes to the show. Listen out for them as they help make us the world's best sounding podcast. As always, the great business insights you hear on That Great Business Show are only made possible thanks to our sponsor, the great makers of the world's best shaving oil, De Facto Made in Mayo, sold worldwide. And do not forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have a regular column all about the podcast. So for me, Conall O'Moran, for Mila Bejas, August Slantamal.